of course, one of the big stars on The X-Files, and he's making a documentary called The Truth Is Out There.
One of the things that UFO research has done to me is instill in me a healthy disrespect for the things that government says.
They are poisoning our people. There is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to kill off the majority of the people in the world.
If we don't allow these corrupt banks to fail, then the nation will fail, and there will be no recovery.
Don't stand on the sides of the river and comment on how corrupt and dark and evil everything is. We all know that.
I don't need to have you understand or agree with me or believe. It doesn't matter to me. I know what I know.
The name of our film is?
The Truth Is Out There.
But it really isn't.
But isn't there a universal truth that science is going for?
Perhaps the universal truth is what makes us subjective.
Okay, you just blew my mind.
Someday Christmas men won't be boys, playing with bombs like kids play with toys. On warm December our hearts will see a world where men are free.
His voice can make a Wolverine purr. It's TV's Dean Haglund with his Christmas wish.
Someday I'd like to be a dentist.
A dentist?
That was Dean Haglund's Christmas wish. We now return you to the sounds of the season from downtown Los Angeles, where it's a balmy 81 degrees.
Jingle, jingle bones, jingle all the way. Screech and groan, jingle bones on a witch's Christmas day.
Jingle bones, jingle all the way.
Screech and groan, jingle bones on a witch's Christmas day.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean Haglund, my condolences on the loss of your countryman, fellow Canadian, Alan Thicke.
Yes, thank you. That was a shocker.
When I say loss, again, he's not missing. Nobody misplaced him. I mean the death
right.
Of Alan Thicke.
The heart attack playing hockey, which, believe it or not, is quite common in Canada.
I thought you were going to say it's quite common for former talk show hosts.
No, but in fact, many of us who are comedians from Canada do thank Alan Thicke for, he was one of the first talk shows to expose a lot of Canadian comics, and for kids watching at home going, hey, this is doable, and, you know, because he filmed in Vancouver and got a lot of the comics from Punchlines, which was my home club, and of course, by the time I started there, the show was over. So I never did get to get a television debut on the Alan Thicke show, but yes, quite a surprise.
One of my first introductions, as far as I know, I mean, obviously I was an SCTV fan,
right?
And I'm sure I loved other, you know, Canadian comics and writers and actors. But my first introduction, where I was aware that this was a uniquely Canadian quality of self-deprecation.
Right.
My introduction to that came on the very first night of Alan Thicke's short-lived late-night talk show, Thicke of the Night. He was brought to America by Fred Silverman, former executive at NBC, to be a Johnny Carson competitor. And that went about as well for him as it went for anyone who was a Johnny Carson competitor. But I remember the publicity surrounding Alan Thicke's arrival. And Alan Thicke came out, and the first thing he said in his monologue was, you know, if I was nearly as good as what everyone's been saying, you would have heard of me.
It's true. He was charming. He was affable. He was quick on his feet. He could read his lines. Because we also found out after Alan Thicke left the Alan Thicke show, they continued it when he went down. They continued it in Canada but brought in other actors like Don Heron and the like. But they were doing the same script, so they would have the same guests on, and then Don would be saying the same lines that Alan Thicke said like 3 years previously. And then you went, oh, these talk shows are fake. It's not actually just somebody chatting. It's all sort of scripted. That was an eye-opener for a lot of us in Canada of how talk shows work.
One of my favorite sketches I've ever seen was actually Harry Shearer on an HBO special that he had did a really great Alan Thicke impersonation. And it was at the Hollywood, the Hollywood Halloween parade or something, or the Halloween Hollywood Easter parade, and
right.
he was the host. Alan Thicke was the host, and he introduced it. You know, Harry Shearer as Alan Thicke, saying, right. "Hi, I'm Alan Thicke, and as part of my exclusive 5-year contract to host every parade in North America." I thought he is the perfect guy to do that. And of course, the joke was there is no such parade. Like, Alan Thicke has totally gotten the day wrong and everything. And he's just set up a seat alongside Hollywood Boulevard and is announcing.
But at the same time, you know, as nice and affable, he could also be pretty cutting. There was an episode of the Alan Thicke show where a young comic, I guess he was nervous. All the bits he did on camera were stolen from other comics. And as he sat down, Alan Thicke said, ladies and gentlemen, let's just take a break. How original is this young comic with material we've never, and the audience, of course, didn't realize that, he was being mocked. But the comedians all across Canada realized how cutting that was and gave a tip of the hat and a bravo to Alan Thicke on that one.
Many people, of course, remember Alan Thicke best as either Jason Seaver, the father on the ABC television hit sitcom Growing Pains. It ran for 7 seasons. I missed, I guess, all of the first 7 seasons of it. And he's remembered best for being the father of real life singer Robin Thicke.
Yes, who, of course, I missed all 7 seasons of Robin Thicke's music as well.
And Alan Thicke, in 2013, a big honor, inducted into Canada's Walk of Fame.
Yes, I didn't know we had one of those.
Oh, yeah, that, I guess, answered both our questions then. Does Canada have a Walk of Fame?
I'm sure it does, but you can only see it 3 months a year.
Wow, so I guess follow-up questions would be, where is it? And the answer would be, I don't know. And my final question for you was going to be, are you on the Canadian Walk of Fame? And I guess, honestly, the answer still would be, you don't know, because you don't even...
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I assume it's Toronto, because Toronto thinks it's the center of Canada, and that's sort of something they would do there. Not that I don't love Toronto, don't kid yourself, just that might be where a Walk of Fame would exist if there was one, which there apparently is.
So,
see how little I know about my own country?
Alan Thicke, dead at 69 years of age. Another television fixture for the last several decades was Craig Sager, and you probably don't, you would recognize this man, but the name might not immediately come to mind for you. He was an American sports reporter, covering an array of sports from 81 until very much the week of his death. He first worked for CNN and then for TBS and TNT, and he was best known for his work as a sideline reporter for the National Basketball Association. And in addition to really kind of insightful and self-deprecating and interesting interviews with some of the most prickliest sports figures, he also invariably sported a specimen from his vast collection of preposterously garish sports jackets and suits. He was a 2016 inductee into the Sports Broadcasting Hall of Fame. That alone entitles him to the august position of being remembered in celebrity deaths on your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. But more so, I must say, I was really struck. It is rare when anyone in broadcasting, I guess, sadly, recently, not that rare in the wake of Gwen Ifill dying, but it is rare when anyone in any avenue of broadcasting has such an outpouring of affection in the wake of their death as Craig Sager did. This man, both for his humanity and then also for his long and ongoing and arduous battle with leukemia, through which he continued to work, seemed to really have touched a lot of lives. So, Craig Sager, one of the best in his business. He was, I believe, only 64, maybe 65 years young. Wow. 2016, as we've discussed, Dean, has been rough. As I said recently, I prefer not to see it as 2016 robbing us of so many greats. I prefer to see it as they are all rats leaving a sinking ship. Somehow that makes me feel better.
Yeah? Okay, good. Glad you feel better at that. I'm worried of 2017 with the poor showing of the Saints' congealed blood that didn't liquefy yesterday in Rome. Apparently every year, as a sign of good luck, they bring out a miracle of congealed blood that normally liquefies, and this time it didn't, saying 2017 might be crappy too.
I just don't know who's left to leave us. So if you do tune in for celebrity deaths, I'm hoping you'll be shit out of luck most weeks in 2017, quite honestly. One person we've been remembering really for the past month, and I've been talking about for several months now, Miss Sharon Jones, who died election week here in America. I heard a story about her through our friend Yoshikado, a music journalist and frequent guest on your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. And I verified this story. Of course, I've been playing.
Wait,
some...
we fact check? We fact
I
check
did.
On the show?
I verified this before bringing this up. And so she had died following a long and ongoing, again, arduous battle with cancer, which had returned. But she suffered a heart attack and a stroke while watching the election results on election night. And the reason I wanted to fact check this, because the same thing happened to Gwen Ifill, was it was not a surprise to me, and I did not believe it could be coincidental, that these people died in the immediate wake of the election. Because for many of us, for many people, even if they voted for the individual who won the presidential election, it was a shocking night. It was a shocking night. Now, that might be a pleasant shock, a pleasant surprise. But it was the kind of night that really took the wind out of sails. I felt that way at first. I felt the wind, you know, going, wow, America really has a lot to look at in terms of how much we don't understand each other and so many of the things we've talked about. And so it didn't surprise me to that there were these deaths, and I wondered if they might be linked. But I bring this up for an important reason, because when you are battling something like cancer, you can't afford to have the wind knocked out of your sails, right? You need every ounce of your strength to maintain that fight. And if you let it down for very long at all, you know, the die is cast. And so that's why, you know, I still try to advocate whenever I hear anyone, you know, who seems down and out about what's going on, you know, really to keep your head up and really to keep moving and really maintain a connection to what makes this life worth living for you. Because there are people that if they don't have that, their hold on this life is very fragile.
Oh, Well, there you go. That seems to be a gung-ho rallying cry. Huzzah!
Which also would be a good name for us to change this the name of this podcast to.
To huzzah.
Hey, next week, a little programming note. We are closing out the year with our top 10 TV series of 2016. And one of the shows that I'll talk about, though, I'm not going to say whether or not it's making my list or not, but people who've listened to the show know I've enjoyed it and really found it quite an admirable show, is Marvel's Luke Cage on Netflix.
Yes.
And the last episode is so good and so powerful and deals with so many really interesting social issues in a fairly biting way. And for a comic book series or show, anything from Marvel, it's quite the unusual ending for a Marvel property.
Wow.
But it ends with a performance live from Miss Sharon Jones, which was just almost too much for me to bear.
Wow. How about that?
And so, I'm sorry to all of you who are hearing technical problems we're having. We're having a lot of beeps. We're having a lot of...
Are you still hearing beeps?
We're having a lot of hissing. We're having a lot. So, but again, as I like to point out from time to time, how much do you pay for the podcast? So anyway, so
our
next...
technology's wearing away on us.
Next week's show, top 10 TV series of 2016. It will be our fourth top 10 show of this, our 10th year of bringing you your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, one of 10 shows, such top 10 shows that we are using to commemorate this year 10. Of course, we've already done best musical films, best horror films, best Western films. As I said, television series will be next week.
Right.
Annually, we do our top 10 best films. We'll do our top 10 worst films. We've already promised that we're going to do a top 10 show looking at what we believe to be the 10 most overlooked science fiction films of time.
That's going to be a good one.
And another thing that we're going to do, and actually, why not do a little bit of a production meeting on the air? Our final two top 10 shows will be... And you don't even know this, Dean Haglund. One will be our top 10 all-time favorite fine artists.
Oh, look at you.
Won't that be exciting, getting to learn a little bit about art history? And that includes, of course, photographers and sculptors.
Yeah.
And we'll be doing that. And we will wind up year 10 with our 10th anniversary show, where Dean and I count down our 10 most memorable episodes of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Wow.
But
you know, those are the ones that didn't get recorded. That's the ones I remember.
Yeah, because I never let you forget those.
I know, that's why.
Because you told me they were being recorded. Oh, yeah, no, it's fine. No, it's fine. I can shut off all the power in the building. We won't lose that show. And
oh, see, how memorable is that?
But those of you counting at home know that that's 9 that I've mentioned. So what will be the 10th show? And this will be somewhere after the new year. It's going to be a show all about the documentary we made, the epic documentary, The Truth Is Out There. We're at work on the follow-up to it, to part 2. And we both, in our respective locales, are going to watch that original documentary, and we're going to jot down some notes, and we're going to share the top 10 things that occur to us now watching the film all these years later.
All these years. It seems like we just finished that. I can't believe it's all these years
later.
Yeah,
I mean, we shot it in 2009, premiered it in 2011, so it's been quite a while. And so it'll be interesting to see what we learned from it, what we have forgotten, what has changed. Yeah, whatever occurs to us now. So you may want to, if you're a proud possessor of a copy of The Truth Is Out There, you might want to rewatch that in anticipation of the show. Right now, we're in the midst, are we not, of rebuilding The Truth Is Out There website. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. And it's going to be part of the Dean Haglund website.
So that's exciting. And we'll update people on that. But in the meantime, if anybody wants a copy of the truth is out there, wants to own a copy, a DVD copy, a two-disc collector's edition DVD copy, a Blu-ray copy. If they want these things anywhere in the world, they should write us either at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, spell out chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, or send us a private message to our Facebook page, not our individual pages, to the Chillpack Hollywood Hour page, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood, and send us a message and let us know that you'd like a copy. I'm thinking for listeners of the show, we do some special price break since it's the holidays, the end of the year, and all of this sort of stuff.
Aww.
Maybe we do something, Dean, where it's generous. where it's like 10, 15, and 20. What do you think? Like $10 for the DVD, $15 for the two disc, $20 for the Blu-ray plus shipping wherever people are.
Holy smokes. With that kind of savings, we can't afford not to buy.
Oh, my God. Somehow you scripted a commercial without even knowing I was going to talk about this. Anyway, that's our epic documentary, The Truth Is Out There. And that's enough about what we're going to be talking about in future shows. God knows with the little amount of time we have left, we have a lot to talk about. First of all, I want to thank everyone who got in touch with us about our previous episode, our 500th episode.
Right.
We went on the road to Forest Lawn. We've heard so much feedback from people, and honestly, I'm shocked at how much people liked that show.
Really? Well, it was so much fun. I think you heard us enjoying the damn place, even though many of the highlights were closed on the day we were there. And of course, I didn't delete the previous show off the...
The previous show from years ago. When we went to the DeMille Lasky Barn, the location where the very first feature-length motion picture was made in 1914, and we celebrated the 100th anniversary of that feature film, which means that was summer of 2014, and we had not deleted the files off the recording. Anyway...
Well, see, that's how I make sure that that show, you know, in case there's a technical difficulty 2 years in, we still have backup.
So, and we had some technical problem. Part of the presentation on the last window display, I couldn't record, although I wonder if there was some dampening field preventing me from recording it. I was surprised. Because it's such a weird show, and I guess I should realize that if people are still listening to us after all these years, they're maybe as weird as we are. But I mean, of course, it was fun for us to do. I just sometimes when we're having that much fun, I just think to myself, there's no way anyone's going to enjoy this.
When we have fun, everyone has fun. Isn't that the...
I guess. Pied Pipers of podcasting fun, which may be a new name that Mark Hirschhorn uses to describe us. But he wrote such a lengthy piece in the Huffington Post on our 500th episode, and it was really quite a lovely piece. So thank you, Mark.
Aww.
Thank you, everyone who wrote us. One person wrote us with a correction, and so I would be remiss if I did not read that email. That begins, season's greetings. I must say I do enjoy it when you venture out of your high-tech studio and take your mighty listeners on an audio field trip. Forest Lawn Glendale will definitely be on the itinerary during my next trip to L.A. after I do Dean's walking tour, of course.
Hooray!
However, as a humble bookseller and goddamn pedant, there are a couple of points that I feel need correcting. They were understandable and, I fear, fairly common mistakes. There's no shame in that. After all, how are you going to know if nobody tells you? Isn't that true, Dean Haglund? As creative people, we need to embody the ability to be wrong. Because if we don't take chances, if we're not wrong, we're not going to find new things. We're not going to learn new things, for crying out loud.
Exactly. So the only guy who's right is the guy who doesn't do anything.
Somebody had to tell me, this listener writes. I'm referring to your mention of the author of The Loved One. So this is on me. The first name is pronounced with a long E, as in Eve. Evelyn. It is generally pronounced like this when it's a man's name. Arthur Evelyn St. John, which of course is pronounced St. John because, you know, they're English. Waugh.
Right.
So it's Evelyn Waugh. 1903 to 1966, an English writer of novels, biographies, and travel books. He was also a prolific journalist and reviewer of books. You know, recently I took a tour of Forest Lawn, which is what inspired this whole thing, and it was a travel book writer himself who took me on the tour of Forest Lawn. Evelyn Waugh's most famous works include the early satires Decline and Fall, 1928, and A Handful of Dust, 1934, the novel Brideshead Revisited, 1945, and the Second World War trilogy, Sword of Honor. Waugh is recognized as one of the great prose stylists of the English language in the 20th century. So there you go. He's definitely...
Fantastic.
Definitely worth reading. So by the way, that's as far as I can tell, that's I've reread this email many times. That's only one correction. So I heard multiple corrections were needed, but that's only one correction, Evelyn Waugh. Anyway, there you go.
Well, maybe you said it multiple times.
He's one mistake several times. I got you.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
By the way, the letter continues. What are you reading? I'm reading Stolen Continents, The New World Through Indian Eyes Since 1492 by Ronald Wright. Your faithful listener, Stephen D. Fowler, and the Smokin' All-Stars. And, of course, Stephen D. Fowler is the proprietor of Booksmith Quality Used Books. And Booksmith Quality Used Books, Dean Haglund, are the proud sponsor of what we are reading.
Yay!
What are you reading, Dean Haglund?
Well, holy smokes. I am reading a bunch of things. The least not being my trusted book I go to, The New Artist Manual, which is a Bible for artists everywhere in terms of how to do techniques in watercolor and oils. And I'm reading that front to back again because... I have a plethora of commissions and work coming up, and I have to streamline my process a bit, and this book is the one to go to. So it's called The New Artist Manual. Every artist, I think, has one, and I'm reading it again.
I am halfway through reading Dispatches from Pluto, which I've spoken about, by journalist Richard Grant, British journalist, who... moved to the Mississippi Delta and wrote about his experiences. I am halfway through reading the history book The Comedians, about the history of stand-up comedy, by Cliff Nesteroff, and I am one-third of the way through The Secret History of Twin Peaks, a novel by Mark Frost that sets up not only the events between the original series and the new revival series that launches in April on Showtime, but also about the paranormal history of that era going all the way back to the Lewis and Clark expedition. And it's a fascinating read, especially for me. It's in the form of an FBI dossier, a dossier authored by an unknown person that an agent has had to go through and verify. So there's several layers to the story, and there's notations, and it's great because it's laid out kind of like how people are used to reading websites now. And the other reason it's such an interesting read for me personally is because of our explorations for Truth Is Out There, we learned a lot about the paranormal history of that era. And as far as I can tell, Mark Frost is hewing closely to real accounts of that era. And I'm having a really tricky time figuring out when he's introducing fictional pieces to tie in later. So that's great. You know, it's it's like watching a magician. You know that it's a trick, but you can't tell where the trick is, and it's endlessly fascinating trying to find it out. And indeed, Dean, it seems like that password required prompt is never going to leave us for this show.
No.
Which makes me think, good news, everybody. 2 weeks from now, when you listen to our New Year's resolution show, you're going to hear that prompt as well. But I bet you won't on next week's show.
Nah, how clever is that?
Oh, my goodness. So we'll just keep limping along here, Dean Haglund. And, hey, let's talk about some live events of the week. I'm curious about whether you've been doing any. I know I've gone to a couple that I'd like to share with you. So let's play a little sting, shall we?
Let's do that.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Have you gone to any live events or participated in any lately, Dean Haglund?
Well, funny you should say that. It's Christmas time here in Australia and the
everywhere.
Improv community.
It's kind of Christmas time, yeah.
Well, except you're in your shorts and T-shirts and drinking beer outside. Yeah, I don't know
as I always do. I just wander the street in a short in shorts and T-shirt, drinking beer, waving at passing cars.
Well, that's Christmas in Australia. And one of the live events was the annual improv show where it's all improvisers from all different groups jamming together, participated in that. But also really fun, our Christmas card this year was have your dogs taken to have his picture taken with Santa. So there's nothing like a large Doberman and an actor who dressed in the Santa gear in sweltering heat, looking completely frightened. That a Doberman is in his lap getting his picture taken. So that's kind of a live event.
I was fortunate enough to get to MC a Christmas party celebration on the final meeting of the year of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club.
And oh, yes.
It was great fun, full of reminiscences of Christmas past. There were live performances. There was a slideshow of the year in pictures. It was great. It really was great fun. I mean, imagine the most fun Christmas party you've ever been to, and imagine that taking place at 7 o'clock in the morning. And that was what it was. I mean, there was something even more magical about starting a day that way. I went to the Christmas mixer for the Esoteric Society. And this is the society,
yes,
you know, run by Richard Shave and his wife. They do historic tours all over this fine city. They do a lot of history work. They also run the Lava Society for a Visionary Alliance. And the party was at the Lummis home, El Alisal, in Highland Park, which was open for this rare occasion. It's only ever open a few hours on weekends, and it was open for us as a private event, so we got to take a tour of the Lummis home. And this is a great place. I've actually filmed there before, but I never really learned so much about it or Charles Lummis and why he's such an important figure in L.A. And I wanted to share a little bit of his story, because if you don't know it, Dean, this is incredible stuff. He was born in 1859, Charles Lummis. He grew up in New England. He was working in Ohio on a newspaper when he was hired to be the first ever city editor of the Los Angeles Times in 1885. So he was all of 26 years old.
Wow.
He walked to Los Angeles from Ohio.
Wow.
Upon taking the job in 1885, sending dispatches of articles he was writing as he traveled. And those articles became syndicated so that by the time he arrived in L.A. to take his new job, he was already famous all across the country.
Fantastic.
Isn't that
awesome?
Taken. Yeah,
that is awesome.
He, after leaving the newspaper business, he became a publisher, and in fact, he was the first publisher for one Jack London.
Oh,
yeah. So
how about
I mean,
that?
He published some really important books. He became the first director of the Los Angeles Public Library. He wrote about Southwestern history. He fell in love with the Southwest on that walk.
Wow.
He established the Sequoia Society to improve the treatment of Native Americans. He started the movement to preserve the Spanish missions. That work actually earned him a knighthood from the King of Spain. He built El Alisal, which is translated as elder groves. In this case, it was a grove of old sequoias on the property. And it's in the southwestern style, and it was self-built. I mean, he was not a rich man. For all these things that he did, he was a very important man, but he was not a rich man. And he put his money where his interests were. And since 1965, the home has served as the headquarters of the L.A. Historical Society, and it's now part of the Southwestern Museum in nearby Highland Park, which he opened many, many decades ago. So what an interesting figure, huh? Charles Lummis.
Yeah. How about that? And had not really heard much about him.
Yeah.
So this is an eye-opener.
And this is a place you would love. This is a house you would really love to check out and grounds. So that might need to be a future field trip for you when you come around here. Now, what are your New Year's Eve plans, Dean Haglund?
Well, they're going to be in a lovely cabin up on the Australian coastline, overlooking the ocean, and I believe there's in the nearby town, we'll be up on a hill in a ranch surrounded by horses and wildlife, perhaps snakes, and there, a view down to the beach, we will see the fireworks explode from a distance as perhaps we then quietly celebrate the coming of 2017.
Excellent.
Yes. And you?
Well, you know, there is a very cool event. There are always so many events these days taking place at the Queen Mary, a place we both love. And New Year's Eve at the Queen Mary this year, very exciting. First of all, they do a huge fireworks display on New Year's there. And what a better place to view those fireworks and ring in the new year than on deck with a delightful cocktail in hand in the old world opulence of the Queen Mary. But every major room on the boat that night is a party with a different movie theme. So it's a different movie theme party in every one of the major rooms. And that is going on New Year's Eve at the Queen Mary. I can't recommend that as a fun New Year's Eve enough to people. I think tickets are still available for that thing.
That's pretty cool.
But of course, it's always possible that all I'm going to be doing, Dean Haglund, is struggling to catch up on films on the Metacritic consensus list of the best movies. Of 2016, because as you know, I always make sure to see all of them if I can before we do our top 10 movies of the year. And I got to tell you, the Metacritic's been updated over the last several weeks. Some clarity is really starting to emerge. And this is a year where, at least at this point, a handful of my favorite films are not getting any love at all, that have just been really forgotten, really, really overlooked. But one of the most interesting facets of the Metacritic list, and this is not a giveaway, this is not a spoiler for next week's Top 10 television show episode, okay. I don't think, to say something that's not on my list. But one series that was not on my list, even though it has been one of the three or four most acclaimed TV series of the year, is a documentary series called O.J. Made in America.
Right.
And
you love this show.
Well, you're thinking, I think, about... I have not ever talked about this for very good reason. You're thinking about American Crime Story, The People versus O.J. Simpson, which is a fictional show.
Which is also
one of the three or four most critically acclaimed shows of the year. Think of that. Two of the three or four most critically acclaimed shows of the year basically starred O.J. Simpson. Anyway, but one of these is a documentary series, and I don't bring it up on next week's show about the best TV series of the year. And I don't for a very good reason, because it's going to be very high on my list of the best feature films of 2016.
What?
Because this was a 7 hour and 47 minute documentary that had its premiere at Sundance and then played another couple of festivals before having a theatrical release and then shortly on the heels of that, aired as a TV series on ESPN, as a documentary series. And it's from a documentary filmmaker who had worked in the really great ESPN 30 for 30 documentary series. But the point was, its original form and its original debut was as a movie. So I consider it a movie. But it sure says something about how media has changed and how we consume entertainment and how all the traditional distribution apparatus and platforms are breaking down and merging and melding, that maybe the best TV series of the year is also the best movie of the year.
How weird, right? Because this is how now longer stories that need to be told can be broken up and binge watched, and then that then you can have a story arc all at once, and somebody can actually sit, well, not sit for 7 hours, but enjoy it within a 24-hour period, watching all 7 hours of a feature, not being locked in a dark room, as it were.
We've talked about this vis-a-vis the Emmy Awards, which I don't think anybody watches anyway, but for excellence in television, you know, which for so many decades was a oxymoron, but is, you know, there's so much great work worthy of acclaim in the episodic format, let's say. But if it weren't for the fact that you have these organizations of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and they're always going to want to stake out their respective histories and therefore their territory on the entertainment playing field. If it weren't for that, I would think we'd already maybe be having a meaningful conversation about, look, if we need to have awards, and you and I have talked about this before, doesn't it make more sense to break these awards down based on the running times of the material being watched and not about the platform on which they're watched?
Very true, because the platform becomes meaningless as we integrate all our
media, as technology and exhibition in the home gets better and audio gets better and all these things. Yeah.
That the consumable, how does that go again? The content beats the medium. I forget Marshall McLuhan's whole longer than the mediums than the message. He had a longer idea on that.
Well, that was exciting.
Yes, sorry. I'm sure that jet plane that's flying over my head is also now.
Anyway, we are in the throes of awards season, the season of self-congratulation. The SAG-AFTRA nominations were announced. The Golden Globe nominations were announced. I don't really want to get into the weeds on those, on who was picked and who wasn't. I'd rather talk about just a couple of different films that either are getting love or are not getting loved. One of which that does not seem to be getting loved, but which opens on Christmas Day, is something from director Peter Berg and actor-producer Mark Wahlberg, and it's called Patriots Day. And it recounts the investigation in the hours and days and weeks following the Boston Marathon bombing.
Oh, right.
And with the exception of the casting of Kevin Bacon, and God bless him, he's doing everything he can not to inspire you to close your eyes and wish it was anyone other than Kevin Bacon. But you can't help it, because it's still Kevin Bacon. And that doesn't mean that he's not a good actor. It just means you see Kevin Bacon. You see him, and you want to see the guy. You want to see the guy. You know, and that's always the tricky part of these kind of movies. But with the exception of that, this is a movie that I thought did a really, really good job of letting me know what it was like to be in that city, to be in the midst of that investigation. And if anything, was kind of an important movie right now to offer up a reminder of why we are lucky to have police departments and why from time to time we need to have police departments.
Oh, right. From time to time.
Yeah.
Why we need them. I would always think we... This is Durkheim's necessity of crime and authority, as we learn in any criminology sociological class, that without crime you have no way of approaching anybody on the street and knowing if they're friend or foe without a society that already puts people away.
It was a really interesting chapter in America's history, but also in, obviously, in Boston's history, and it was a real challenge for a while for the authorities to let the public that had so often opposed them for various reasons, to let the public work for them was such a challenge for the authorities in this instance. And yet the result of it at the end, of course, is so many of these police officers are experiencing being cheered by a crowd for the first time in their lives in Boston. And anyway, it's a very emotional, it's very heart-wrenching. I mean, we know the details of the story, but I didn't even know what an action film this real-life adventure to track down the culprits was. And there is some wonderful, Kevin Bacon notwithstanding, there is some wonderful character casting in this. By some young actors, especially, who are just doing breathtaking, heart-wrenching work. And the work that was done, obviously, I bet Peter Berg, I think Peter Berg is probably from there. You know Mark Wahlberg is from there. And the painstaking detail that they create, you know, that they create on screen could only have been the product of even more painstaking research and interviews with those who could offer firsthand accounts. And the end credits offers up many talking head interviews with these firsthand accounts. And it's the best use of this kind of footage I've ever seen a narrative film use. It really is an interesting combination of narrative and ultimately then documentary. And I found it quite compelling. And I'm surprised that it's not getting award love this season.
Well, I think in my mind, why I would give this a pass is because it was so media saturated that I think I know the whole story. Am I wrong there? Is there things that that somehow the 24-hour news coverage missed in telling me that story?
I don't know, but that is interesting. There is a lot of insight into how that 24-hour news cycle was affecting the investigation.
Right.
So that might be interesting in and of itself, both where they got things wrong and where, when they had things right, they were trying to push an investigation that, where safety was concerned, shouldn't be pushed there yet. So, anyway, I don't know. All I can say is that there were things that I did not know. Like, oh my goodness, what a shootout this thing became with the suspects. And anyway, I found it to be an exciting film, and like I said, heart-wrenching, obviously, but also quite uplifting, really, in its regard. I don't know if I've spoken about the film Lion. If I have already, please forgive me. But in the wake of it getting nominations, especially for Dev Patel and Nicole Kidman, let me just address that the people who voted to give them those nominations are out of their fucking minds.
Wow.
Dev Patel's performance in Lion is one of the all-time worst performances by any actor in a supporting role I have ever seen. There is nothing in it that attempts to be authentic. It is just a whole opportunity for him to try to seem cool for a whole movie, to position himself as some kind of studly romantic lead, to play... And by the way, I saw him on stage with the guy he's playing. He did nothing to try to embody this real person. The movie focuses, for the most part, on a little boy who gets trapped on a train in his province in India, falls asleep, and when he wakes up, he's 1,600 kilometers from where he began. He's a little boy. He never even learned the correct pronunciation of the town that he's from, and when he ends up 1,600 kilometers away, he's in a part of India where they speak a totally different language. So he is stranded from his family. He ends up bouncing around on the streets. He ends up going to an orphanage. He ends up being adopted to a white family in Tasmania. The mother is played by, the adoptive mother is played by Nicole Kidman, and she absolutely is game to bring it in a movie that could have been about the real problems that she faced and the problems of raising, you know, children from another culture and especially this specific culture. There was so much interesting material, all of which they decided they shouldn't explore. A credit to Nicole Kidman for letting them put on as much makeup as they could to try to create what wrinkles and expressions look like on most people's faces, since she has long ago corrected out any genuine human expressions from the mask that she calls a face.
Wow.
So, Lion, if you tell me that Nicole Kidman and Dev Patel are given among the best performances of the year, you're a Lion. Hear what I did there? But the young kid who plays the little boy, his performance is quite impressive. It is a true story, and it's brought to you by the good folks at Google Earth.
No, it's not.
It is. It is. Now, not an award favorite by any means, but a horror film. And as you know, I've been really embracing the horror. But somehow a movie called Lights Out got recommended to me, Dean. And I really wish it hadn't. Because it reminds me of why I rejected the horror medium for so long. And it's because it is the medium where it's easiest to get a bad movie made.
Right.
And this is a movie that was directed by David Sandberg and Jose G. Ramos, and it was based on a 3-minute short film that David Sandberg made and put up, I think, on Vimeo. And it got such traction that then they said, hey, do you want to expand it in the feature? Do I? And he does
Who doesn't?
And the feature is an excellent 3-minute short film that would have made for an excellent standalone X-Files episode if we had the interesting characters of Mulder and Scully walking through this. But it involves an experiment resulting in photosensitivity, someone who's so sensitive to the light that they actually disappear in the light. And so there's a wonderful, wonderful setup at the heart of this, but there's nothing else that's real. Indeed, there's no story, there's no characters, there's no reason we wanted to tell this particular story. But I bring it all up because you know my adage for a long time, even though I've gotten over a lot of my, prejudice towards short films.
Mm-hmm.
When someone makes a great short film, congratulations, you've now proven you know how to make a short film.
Right.
Making a feature is completely different. Completely different. And I think just because you've made a good short film, you are no closer to knowing how to make a feature than someone who never made a short film. They're different languages altogether. Yeah. That's what I would say.
Right. Well, that is
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but still, it is different languages altogether. Finally, Dean, there's a Star Wars movie that has come out.
Oh, I've been receiving a text or two about it.
Have you?
Telling me, yes, that rarely do I go and even answer or look at text going, have you seen this movie yet? .. question mark, smiley face, whatever emoji thing. But this has been coming into my phone down here, of all things.
Well, you were actually enthusiastic about seeing Force Awakens. And you saw it early on. And I've never seen you as angry as as you were after seeing Force Awakens.
Yeah.
And I said, it wasn't a bad film, Force Awakens, but there, again, all it was an effort to, hey, let's recapture what's cool about Star Wars, right? It was nostalgia in plastic packaging.
Exactly. Told exactly in the same format, from the same point of view of a robot running around, a droid.
Without any connection to the deeper mythological underpinnings that were the inspiration for that original story to be told.
Right, yeah.
And so it was the worst of what competent modern filmmaking has to offer. In other words, it was J.J. Abrams. This Rogue One, a Star Wars story, written for a large part by Tony Gilroy, and as it turns out, if my sources are to be believed, actually directed by Tony Gilroy, who took over for an in over his head Gareth Edwards. That's what I'm hearing.
Right.
It is, for me, much more enjoyable than Force Awakens.
Okay, hooray.
Should I start with what they do well?
Let's do that. Let's always delve in the positive.
For the first time in I don't know how many Star Wars movies. Maybe all of them? I don't know. No, maybe since Empire Strikes Back, I actually had a feeling of what it would be like to be there in the worlds that they're creating. There is
fantastic.
A verisimilitude. There is an immediacy, both in terms of the texture and the geography and the human emotions being portrayed.
Well, there's some happiness.
It's so hard to do this without any kind of spoilers. But, you know, you were someone who said that instead of spending time concocting things like Force Awakens, there are so many stories worthy of exploration in the margins or just in those opening title crawls from the original movies, right? This is the opening line of a New Hope title crawl is Rogue One.
Right.
And it makes for interesting story. Now, at its worst, we know what's going to happen to all these people. We know they are all going to perish in their effort to get the plans to the rebellion. We know this.
Nobody dies of old age in a retirement home?
And the problem is that knowing that, I think they try to build up every one of the main characters' demise to be really iconic, to be really poetic, to be really moving, when, first of all, they never achieve it, and secondly, when the quiet moment might be the one that stands out the most, especially in a Star Wars universe.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's disappointing. But they're smart enough to know that they still needed an ending. And so the movie ends with the plans getting to Princess Leia. And so we see those rebel guards who will be lined up at the beginning of A New Hope by that iconic white door. We see many of their kin being killed off in hand-to-hand combat that makes Star Wars suddenly, for a brief period of time, an R-rated movie for adults.
Wow.
And that drives home in a really potent way the cost of you know what these people are striving for, and it's so powerful, and So riveting. And as the plans get away and as that white door shuts down, that iconic white door that we're going to see defended at the beginning of A New Hope, when that closes just in the nick of time to get Princess Leia's transport ship away with the plans, your blood is pumping and you're ready to start watching A New Hope right away. So it would be really fun if they re-release as a double feature. I think that would be great, great fun. But this is really, to me, the first one since, I guess I would say, Return of the Jedi that actually has a reason for being.
Ah, see, that's the thing. There has to be a compelling reason why you have to tell this story. And, absolutely, what is the whole beginning of the rebellion about?
And I know this is nutty, but I kind of love that after all these years, I got another performance on screen. I get to watch another performance on screen by the late Peter Cushing. Because Governor Tarkin, the head of the Death Star, is a major character in this. And,
really?
And it is a CGI Peter Cushing.
Wow.
And it's as good as we've seen it. It's scary good. It's scary good. Do they go to the well too often? Maybe by bringing in another character later, but it's really good. Do I have questions? Do I have problems with it? I already mentioned some. I have others, but it, like I said, at least this one has a reason for being. It's a lot of fun, and I'm glad I saw it.
Right.
Well,
so there you go.
So many other movies to discuss, but we'll have to discuss them in the weeks following the new year, because that brings us to an end of this very exciting, troubled, tortured installment of Your Chill Back Holiday Hour.
Technically clever.
Dean, people can find every episode of their Chill Back Hollywood Hour, can they not?
500 of them. Think of that.
Well, this is 501.
Yes. So there you go.
They can
more
find them at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review.
We've told people how to write us, and they should, either at our Yahoo address or on Facebook, in order especially to let us know if they want the truth is out there, or if there's something they want us to discuss after the new year. But they should also follow us on Twitter and Instagram, shouldn't they?
They should, because we're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word "and," and check out some of that hashtag that's going on their Instagram.
Hashtag we give good hashtags. We post one picture every week. I'm a little overdue today to get that. And of course, this show is coming at everybody a few hours late this week. We apologize for that, and we apologize for the technical difficulties. And we'll be back next week with our final show of 2016. Until then. Happy holidays, happy Christmas, happy Hanukkah,
happy
everybody.
Everybody. Yeah, absolutely. Till then.
Happy Christmas to you, Dean Haglund.
Oh, I'm going to put my shorts on and get in the hammock. That's what I'm doing.
After we pre-record another show. Okay, goodbye.
See ya.
Belated spoiler alert.